Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we begin our month-long series on presidential elections. We hope that on November 7th you'll exercise your constitutional right to vote and help elect the next president of the United States. To help you prepare, we decided to provide you with some historical perspective on the election process and on the qualities that have helped or hindered some of our presidents when they assumed office. But before we get to that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. It's difficult to imagine former United States Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren, seen as one of the nation's leading civil rights advocates, supporting the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. But he did when he was Attorney General and Governor of California. Warren gained a national reputation for being an unyielding, hard-working conservative. And when President Dwight Eisenhower appointed him Chief Justice of the Supreme Court this week in 1953, most people expected him to bring his conservative views to the bench. Instead, one year later, he led the court in its landmark decision in Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, which made unconstitutional the continued segregation of the nation's public schools. The Warren Court, as it came to be known, went on to render several such decisions that established that judicial body in history as a guarantor of civil liberty and equality. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, add to the list of the wonders of DNA the ability to help African Americans figure out where their ancestors came from before they were enslaved. In Boston, some 300 African-American schoolchildren are submitting DNA samples as part of a project that a local molecular biologist hopes will yield information on their African roots. At Howard University in Washington, D.C., a geneticist is offering DNA analysis to African-Americans who wish to trace their origins. The greatest travesty for African-Americans is not the diseases we suffer, nor is it the social injustice we have to face, one of the scientists involved explained. It is that we are disconnected from our beginnings. We have no connection to where we came from, and that has to end. What was once a dietary staple for Union soldiers during the Civil War is being marketed once again. G.H. Bent, a Massachusetts cracker maker, is selling hardtack, the flour and water biscuits that got their name for being very hard and rather dry. They may not make it to your supermarket shelves, but Bent is selling hardtack over the Internet to Civil War battle reenactors who have given the product enthusiastic reviews for its authenticity. You're listening to Talking History, a much easier thing to swallow. When the authors of the United States Constitution created that segment of the document that deals with presidential elections, they did not anticipate and did not provide for political parties. Nevertheless, political parties did appear, and the results in some early elections proved problematic. Here to discuss two of these early extraordinary elections of 1800 and 1824 is Paul Finkelman, Chapman Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Tulsa College of Law. Professor Finkelman is the author of more than a dozen books and scores of articles on the Constitution and the presidency. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much. It's a delight to be on the air.
Get us started by explaining the results of the election of 1800.
Well, the easy answer is that Thomas Jefferson became president. The hard answer is, how did he get to be president? And in order to understand that, we have to go back to how the framers set up the Constitution to elect the president. Under the Constitution, as it was first written, each state would be allocated a certain number of presidential electors. The number was determined by adding to the two senators the numbers of members of the House of Representatives that each state had. So the minimum number of electors would be three. The electors would then vote for two candidates for president. The person who got the most votes would become president, and the person who got the second most votes would become vice president. This worked wonderfully in the first election. Everybody voted for George Washington, and the second person to get the second the highest number of votes was John Adams. It didn't work quite so well Two terms later, however, when John Adams was elected president, and by that time his political enemy, Thomas Jefferson, was elected vice president. However, in 1800, the whole thing fell apart because all of the electors who were in favor of Thomas Jefferson also voted for the person who they saw as his running mate, Aaron Burr, a politician from New York. The result was that both Burr and Jefferson each got 73 electoral votes, and therefore they were tied. And under the Constitution, if no person has a majority of the electoral votes, or if there's a tie for the majority, then it goes to the House of Representatives. And so the House of Representatives had to choose who was going to be president. Each House delegation would vote as a single delegation. And the result was that there was a huge problem on getting anybody elected. Jefferson had a solid number of states that voted for him on every ballot. People who didn't like Jefferson, who had supported Adams, and who were in the majority in their states voted for Burr, just to spite Jefferson. But in a number of the congressional delegations, there was a tie. If there were, for instance, two congressmen, one supporting Burr, one supporting Jefferson, that state wasn't counted at all. And so for ballot after ballot after ballot, they couldn't get a majority of the state delegations in the House to vote for a single candidate. Finally, a compromise was worked out. Some of the opponents of Jefferson didn't show up at the House so that their states would now have a majority for Jefferson, and Jefferson was elected president, and Burr became vice president.
Was it understood early on that Burr was to be the vice president, or were they just both running for the same position from the same party?
Well, Jefferson understood that Burr was his running mate, and I think most of the Jeffersonians understood that Burr was his running mate. But when Burr discovered that he had the exact same number of electoral votes as Jefferson, Burr said, hey, I'm equally in contention for the president. I have as many electoral votes as Jefferson. Why should I not get it? Why should he get it? And so Burr basically tried to steal the election as president when he was really running as vice president. What's significant is that all the supporters of Jefferson's party voted for Jefferson, and that the people who had opposed both Jefferson and Burr, they're the ones who supported Burr in Congress.
Okay, and there was no way for the electors to identify that they wanted one vote to go for Burr as vice president and another vote to go for Jefferson as president.
No, and in fact, that was the problem with the Electoral College as it was set up. The framers were idealists. They didn't think there would be political parties. So they thought the two best candidates would be president and vice president. They had no notion of party block voting. And as a result, they face this dilemma. They immediately, by the way, the nation immediately dealt with this by adopting the 12th Amendment, which said that the electors in the future would designate one person for vice president and one for president. And that solved the problem.
Well, I want to talk about Jefferson as president in a moment, but let's fast forward just for a moment here and talk about the results of the election of 1824. What happened then?
Well, in the in 1824, we had no political parties, and this is sort of an important lesson, I think, for Americans as we think about our political structure. Some people condemn political parties for all kinds of good and bad reasons, but one of the virtues of political parties is that they organize the vote, and they allow for a structure that gets us a president at every election. By 1824, there were no political parties at all. The Federalist Party, which had elected Washington and Adams, had disappeared. The Jeffersonian Republicans, who later called themselves the Democratic Republicans and later the Democrats, they had swallowed up everybody. So everybody was sort of a national Republican. That's what they were calling themselves in the 1820s. And as a result, there were four candidates competing for the presidency. William Crawford from Georgia, Henry Clay from Kentucky, John Quincy Adams, the son of the second president from Massachusetts, and Andrew Jackson, who was from Tennessee, although born in North Carolina, the hero of the War of 1812. Jackson got the largest number of popular votes. He also got the most electoral votes, with Adams running second. But nobody had a majority, and so once again it went to the House of Representatives. And in the House of Representatives, Henry Clay, who had run fourth, decided that he preferred Adams to Jackson and used his tremendous political skills to lobby for Adams, and enough people voted for Adams so that he carried a majority of the House delegations, and so he was elected president. Adams then proceeded to make Clay a Secretary of State. Jackson said this was a dirty bargain and complained about it bitterly. Probably there was no bargain at all. Adams wasn't bargaining. He simply chose Clay because he thought Clay was the best person for the job. The ironic thing, of course, is why shouldn't there have been a bargain? Because politics is always about making bargains.
Did this lead to any political party realignment?
Well, it does. What happens is Jackson immediately starts campaigning for the 1828 election. And what emerges out of the Jackson movement is what would today be the modern Democratic Party. And Jackson runs a vigorous campaign in 1828, unseats John Quincy Adams quite handily, and then goes on to serve two important terms as President of the United States, and leaving a legacy not only of something called Jacksonian democracy, which leads to universal adult white male suffrage, and also, by the way, leads to the disfranchisement of free blacks who could vote in a few states where they lose the vote under the Jacksonian democracy, as it's called. But more important, Jackson leaves as a legacy the Democratic Party as a functioning political party. The followers of Adams realign themselves into something called the Whig Party.
Okay, let's go back now and look at, because this series is not only concerned with elections, but with the qualities of those elected to office. So if we go back to, let's just simply compare Adams and Jefferson as presidents, in very brief form, in terms of the qualities they brought to the office, how would you differentiate the two?
Well, Adams brought enormous political experience. He had been involved in the revolutionary movement in Massachusetts early on. He was a constitution maker. He wrote pretty much by himself the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, which is still in force. It is the oldest constitution in the world that is still in force. Every other state but one has rewritten its constitution, and that one was a state that entered the Union in the 19th century. Except Massachusetts. What Adams wrote, it's been amended a few times, but it's still in place. He was a very well-educated, very smart man. He was also not much of a politician. He was rather pompous. He had kind of a tin ear when it came to listening to the people. Jefferson, of course, was very different. Jefferson wasn't, I think, as well-educated or as well-trained as Adams. But he was apparently brilliant in conversation. People who met him often tended to be thoroughly charmed by him. And he was brilliant at turning a phrase, writing things that people appreciated. In terms of their policies, there were some very significant differences. Jefferson favored France in the ongoing European wars, while Adams favored England. Jefferson was a slave owner. He owned about 200 slaves at the time he became president, and his policies reflected his pro-slavery views in a number of ways. Adams, on the other hand, had never owned slaves, thought slavery was utterly immoral, and his policies differed from Jefferson. I'll give you a specific example. The French colony of Haiti had witnessed massive slave revolts in the 1790s, and by the time Adams left office, Haiti was an independent republic run by former slaves. Adams was on the verge of recognizing Haiti as an independent republic. We had high-level ministerial exchanges with Haiti. We were about to give them full diplomatic recognition. Jefferson came in and immediately stopped this, and in fact proposed to France that the United States would provide weapons and food if the French sent an army to reconquer Haiti and to re-enslave its population. We can only wonder when we see the current tragedies of American politics with the poverty and political instability of Haiti, how that nation's history might have been different if instead of going to war against Haiti, which is really what the United States does, at least in terms of stopping trade with Haiti under Jefferson, Jefferson had used his skills to teach Haiti about democracy. Our nation might be better off as well if we had taken that route. So there were real differences between these two men.
Interesting. And what about John Adams's son, John Quincy Adams, as compared to Andrew Jackson?
Well, John Quincy Adams was probably the single most prepared person to ever be president of the United States. As a young man, before he was 12, he had gone to Europe with his father, who was a diplomat during the American Revolution. He had been a young diplomat himself in the Washington administration. He had gone to Harvard. He was a skilled lawyer. He had then gone into the U.S. Senate, and he had served as Secretary of State under both James Madison and James Monroe, so he was a skilled diplomat and a master at the intricacies of government. He, like his father, however, was a terrible politician. No one warmed up to him. He was perceived of as cold. And in that sense, he was the exact opposite of the charismatic Jackson, the war hero, the Indian fighter, the man who had defeated the British at the Battle of New Orleans. And in terms of the public perception of them, Jackson certainly seemed to stand for the common man. Jackson was a man who had little education, was mostly self-educated. He had been born with nothing in his family. He'd born in poverty on the frontier, and he had sort of clawed his way to the top, whereas Adams had been the son of a president. And while not wealthy, the Adamses were not rich. Adams had had many advantages.
Interesting. So it almost sounds like you're saying intelligence and preparation aren't always the keys to success in the office.
I think that's true. I think intelligence and preparation are one of the keys. Adams is actually a fairly successful president. If one looks at his 4 years in office, there are no great disasters. Our foreign policy moves forward in ways that enhance the credibility and the fame of the United States. In domestic policy, we have relative economic stability. We have relative economic growth. It's hard to look at the 4 years of the Adams administration and see anything that he did wrong. He is simply not perceived of as popular. Jackson, on the other hand, is perceived of as very popular at the time. But some of what he did, we no doubt look back and shudder with horror. For example, it is Jackson who initiates the removal of most of the Native Americans who lived east of the Mississippi, forcing them to move to what was then the Indian Territory, now my home state of Oklahoma. Many of the Cherokee were moved on what is known as the Trail of Tears, where probably a third of them died along the way, and another third of them may have died when they reached Oklahoma because the United States didn't provide them with food or shelter or even blankets to keep them warm. So, you know, much of Jackson's administration, I think we would look back on and wonder how America could be so cruel. But at the time, he was perceived of as being very popular.
And he was reelected, and so was Jefferson, but neither of the Adams. But
that's right. And the other thing Jackson did, he made war on something called the Bank of the United States, which was a financial institution, sort of the early 19th century equivalent of the Federal Reserve, which had organized and rationalized the economy, provided for a national currency. At the time, there was no American dollar bills. There was no national currency, so this national bank, the Bank of the United States, meant printed currency which circulated at face value all over the country, so you actually had a national economy. Jackson hated the bank, and withdrew all the U.S. deposits from it and vetoed a bill to recharter it. And that, among other things, threw us into the greatest depression of American history until the 1890s, known as the Panic of 1837. Mm-hmm. His successor, Martin Van Buren, was elected and then immediately hit with this panic and, of course, was not reelected.
Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it at that, unfortunately. We're out of time, but thanks, Paul, for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Paul Finkelman, Chapman Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Tulsa College of Law. And this is Talking History.
The college don't remember, but Tuesday's just as bad.
In addition to discussing the history of elections in the United States, part of our month-long series will be devoted to considering the qualities of leadership some of our better-known presidents brought to the office, making them more or less successful. Here to revisit the presidency of Harry Truman is Alonzo Hemby, Distinguished Professor of History at Ohio University and the author of Man of the People, A Life of Harry S. Truman.
Scholars rate Harry Truman as a near great chief executive, although he was neither good at delivering a prepared speech nor a compelling television personality. He was a successful president because he drew on a wide and varied experience, practiced a measured decisiveness, had a guiding ideology, and possessed a sense of the public interest that transcended partisanship. Truman had been a farmer, a captain of artillery, a failed haberdasher, a respected local politician who had to work with an unsavory political machine, and an esteemed United States senator. He took his share of hard knocks in business, found himself as a leader in the crucible of frontline combat, and walked the narrow, difficult line between personal honesty and the imperatives of organization politics. Along the way, he learned a lot about human nature, fate, risk, and the necessities of political survival. From his authorization of the use of the atomic bomb to end World War II, to the dismissal of General Douglas MacArthur during the Korean War, Truman was a decision maker, but never an impulsive one. He appointed committees, consulted advisors, took his time. Letters to music critics who did not like his daughter's singing voice were, of course, another matter. Truman, we all know, was a feisty partisan. Who can forget him telling the 1948 Democratic Convention, "Senator Barkley and I are going to win this election and make those Republicans like it." But beneath the partisanship was an ideology that saw the Democratic Party as the party of working people, defined broadly as farmers, blue-collar workers, small businessmen, even a black minority that had too long been denied basic civil rights. And partisanship had its limits. Throughout his political career, Truman enjoyed good, mutually supportive relations with many moderate to progressive Republicans. It is too easily forgotten that the Marshall Plan, which did much to save Western Europe from Soviet domination, was passed by the Republican 80th Congress. Truman meant it when he said politics stopped at the water's edge. Few of his predecessors had sprung from more common roots. Perhaps none had learned more from the often difficult experience of making good in American democratic society.
You've been listening to Alonzo Hemby, author of Man of the People, A Life of Harry S. Truman. This is Talking History. Continuing our discussion of President Harry Truman, we'd like to recommend to you a site where you can learn much more about the man and his years in office. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Harry S. Truman Museum in Independence, Missouri, is undergoing a major renovation and will be open to the public again beginning in January of 2001. The $22.5 million project is the first since the museum opened in 1957. The new Truman Library will do more than tell the story of a president. It will challenge visitors to explore the events and issues of the Truman era. In February of 2001, the museum will present Presidential Portraits, a special temporary exhibit from the Smithsonian Institution's National Portrait Gallery. And in late spring, a grand reopening of the museum is planned. So if you're heading to the Kansas City area, look for the museum. And while you're there, check out the many Truman-related sites in the greater Kansas City area.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. Man cannot live by politics alone, so let us recommend to you two coming attractions that have nothing to do with presidential elections, but that you will find enjoyable and instructive. The 4th century rhetorician Libanius once wrote, "What city can we say is worthy to be compared with this? It is superior in size, in the nobility of its lineage, in the refinement of its inhabitants, in its pursuit of learning, and in the quality of what its land produces." Libanius was speaking of ancient Antioch, located in what is today southeast Turkey, and the magnificence of that city is now available to you in an exhibit of its finest long-buried treasures that opens this week at the Worcester Art Museum in Worcester, Massachusetts. And premiering on the History Channel the week of October 9 to 12 is Hooked, Illegal Drugs, and How They Got That Way. On October 9th, watch for A History of Marijuana and Methamphetamine. On October 10th, opium, morphine, and heroin. On the 11th, cocaine, and on the 12th, the history of LSD, ecstasy, and the raves. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact times of these History Channel programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we will continue our month-long series on presidential elections by taking a look at the presidencies of Abraham Lincoln and Dwight Eisenhower. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.